people think hope are not going to go away until their children and their families are safe.
King Cove residents sue over a road to Cold Bay. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an early morning shakeup for Southeast.
The building shook quite a bit, and then it felt like I was on the water, and it lasted pretty long too. Maybe about a minute and a half.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Tribes, local governments, and residents from the King Cove region are suing federal officials for denying them the right to build a road through a wildlife refuge. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal has more.
King Cove residents have been arguing for years that a road would be the easiest, safest way to get to emergency medevac flights at the all-weather airstrip in Cold Bay. They didn't stop arguing when Interior Secretary Sally Jewell decided in December that she wouldn't allow a land swap in the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. That had been the best hope for getting a road built.
We're at the point where we can't let this go and we've got to keep moving forward.
Della Trumbull is a spokeswoman for the King Cove Corporation and the Ogdow Tribe. They're two of the plaintiffs on a lawsuit that was filed Wednesday in United States District Court in Anchorage. The complaint alleges that the Interior Department's decision to reject the road violates the Constitution and several federal laws, including the National Environmental Policy Act and the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. This isn't the first legal action by advocates of the road. In April, the state of Alaska announced that it might sue the federal government to establish a right-of-way through the refuge based on historic use. But Della Trumbull says that's a separate case.
They're related in some ways, but they are not the same. Part of this lawsuit is basically saying that the EIS that was submitted to the secretary is basically inaccurate.
Trumbull is talking about the environmental impact statement, which was completed in 2013. The Interior Secretary used that document to make her final determination on the land swap. Trumbull argues that it didn't provide a full picture.
The EIS technically falls heavily on the side of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife in regard to the wilderness. It does not take into consideration the human factor and the health and safety issues that revolve around it, as directed by Congress.
This spring, Trumbull and several other King Cove officials traveled to Washington, D.C. They wanted to lobby Secretary Jewell to reconsider her decision. In return, Jewell requested a report explaining why a road is the only viable option to get from King Cove to Cold Bay during medical emergencies. Trumbull says the King Cove group turned in that report almost 2 months ago.
But we have not had any communication or response from her to this point.
That's not acceptable, according to Robert Dillon. He's a spokesman for Senator Lisa Murkowski, who's criticized the Obama administration for its handling of the road.
They want the people of King Cove to go away and stop bothering them. And that's the most important thing, is to keep reminding them that this issue remains alive and that the people of King Cove are not going to go away until their children and their families are safe.
A representative for the Interior Department declined to comment because of the pending litigation. The defendants on the lawsuit include Interior Secretary Sally Jewell, along with the Assistant Secretaries for Indian Affairs and Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. Employees of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Eisenbeck Refuge are also listed. In On Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
The first natural gas targeted development project on the North Slope is expected to come online as early as next year. The Point Thompson Field is being developed by ExxonMobil, 60 miles east of Prudhoe Bay. During a project update for the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce yesterday, ExxonMobil Alaska production manager Karen Hagedorn described initial development, which will focus on gas condensate.
It's a liquid production that we can actually pump through a pipeline back into the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and export through the normal infrastructure that we use for oil on the North Slope.
Hagedorn highlighted the significance of a recently completed 22-mile pipeline linking Point Thompson to an existing network of North Slope feeder lines.
So with that pipeline, for the first time, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System is now connected all the way from the National Petroleum Reserve on the west side all the way to the edge of ANWR on the east side of the North Slope. It's all connected up now to the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. So that's a really important development.
Hagedorn said three wells at Point Thompson are expected to begin moving condensate in late 2015 or early 2016. Initial production is targeted to be about 10,000 barrels a day. Hagedorn cautioned that the $4 billion project is only half complete, pointing to work that still needs to be done, including installation of football-size production modules being built in Korea.
We are bringing in these modules from Korea because of their size. There wasn't an option to build them in Alaska, but we do have over 130 truckable modules that were built here in Alaska that are also part of the Point Thompson development, and that includes the housing here and also some of the warehouses and utility buildings. Those were all built here in Alaska.
Hagedorn said 70% of the $2 billion spent so far on Point Thompson has been in Alaska. The Korean modules will be delivered next summer. Dry gas produced from the wells at Point Thompson will be re-injected underground, like it is at Prudhoe Bay, until there's an Alaska natural gas line, a project Hagedorn described as further along than ever before, given industry and state alignment. Local flights were grounded on the Alaska Peninsula today as Pavlov volcano continued to erupt. KUCB's Annie Ropeek has more.
All Penn Air flights in and out of Cold Bay and Unalaska were canceled today amid concerns about volcanic ash blowing in the way of planes. Grant Aviation's flights to and from Unalaska were also canceled. Staff there said bad weather made it hard to keep Pavlov's ash plume in sight. Penn Air spokeswoman Missy Roberts said at least 200 people were impacted by their cancellations today. She's not sure yet if they'll be able to fly tomorrow. If they can, she says they'll try to add extra flights for stranded passengers. Pavlov began erupting on Saturday. Alaska Volcano Observatory geologist Gay McJimsey says the volcano's seismic activity reached a high point yesterday. Its alert status was elevated to a red color code for a short time. It's since been notched back down to orange as the activity decreased. But the volcano's ash and steam plume is still going strong. McJimsey says it was around 20,000 feet in height today, spiking to 30,000 feet at times. The volcano has spread a haze of fine ash over Cold Bay, but McJimsey says there haven't been reports of ash fall there yet. There was a report of ash in Sand Point. Penn Air told the AVO they had to sweep off their runways and plane windshields before flying there today. McJimsey says it's surprising for ash to have blown that way, but not impossible. There haven't been any volcano-related flight cancellations in Sand Point so far. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
An earthquake shook some southeast Alaska residents out of bed early this morning. The Alaska Earthquake Information Center reports the 5.8 magnitude quake hit just before 4 a.m. It was centered about 100 miles northwest of Juneau, 39 miles west of Haines, and 60 miles west of Skagway. There were no immediate reports of damage. Skagway police dispatcher Willicky Burnham says she received a couple of calls from residents after the jolt, and it felt like her office was on a boat.
The building shook quite a bit, and then it felt like I was on the water, and it lasted pretty long, too. Maybe about a minute and a half.
The epicenter was apparently near Rendu Inlet between the east and west arms of Glacier Bay. While there was no tsunami, Tom Vandenberg says 4 a.m. was kind of exciting in the town of Gustavus.
Everything was shaking a little bit and our houses were rocking back and forth.
Vandenberg is supervisory park ranger for Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve. He says two groups of researchers up the east and west arms of the bay radioed some interesting accounts.
We had a group of bear researchers up near Russell Island who were staying on our ranger station, which is a little floating raft, and they reported rocks coming down from some of the hillsides, some strange sounds from icebergs and some rolling bergs, and just kind of an eerie experience, but no major outward damage.
A backcountry ranger crew is camped out near McBride Glacier in the Muir Inlet side of the bay.
And then we also radioed a backcountry crew of rangers that were camped out up near McBride Glacier in the east arm in the Muir Inlet side of the bay. They said McBride Glacier just started calving pretty incessantly, apparently for about 15 minutes straight. So lots of ice coming out of that inlet probably over the next couple of days.
After the initial quake, several light aftershocks continued in northern southeast for more than a couple of hours. according to the Earthquake Information Center. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, wolf numbers continue to decline in Denali National Park.
The question is, what is driving that? And we're fairly uncertain as to what's going on.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
The Bureau of Land Management says it has completed a land transfer for an Alaska Native village. The BLM announced today the signing of the final patent for more than 8,780 acres that fulfills the land entitlement for Chuathbalak under the 1971 Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. The community of about 130 people is located 87 miles northeast of Bethel. The land transfer was made to the Kuskokwim Corporation, which was created in 1977 when 10 Anxa Village corporations merged. Chuathbalak is among the 10 villages. The BLM says the Kuskokwim Corporation received the first conveyance for Chuathbalak in September 2005. In total, the corporation has received nearly 92,700 acres of land surrounding the village, which is located on the north bank of the Kuskokwim River. Almost immediately after the jubilant response to former Fort Richardson soldier Sergeant Bo Bergdahl's release from the Taliban on Saturday, the story took a very different turn. First, there was criticism of the Obama administration for exchanging 5 Taliban detainees for Bergdahl. Then some soldiers from his former unit started speaking out against the freed prisoner of war. As Jessica Robinson of the Northwest News Network reports, Bergdahl's hometown in Idaho was unprepared for the public backlash.
Jane Dressel owns an art supply store in downtown Haley, Idaho. For the last 5 years, she made sure the yellow ribbons for Bergdahl on all the trees on Main Street got replaced once they started to fade. Dressel says when the news of Bergdahl's release first came, for a while it was everything she had imagined.
Saturday and Sunday, everything was, you know, we were so surprised at the events that had happened, and it was just such a joyful, happy moment. And then after Sunday, there seemed to be a turn.
That turn came in the form of angry phone calls and emails, Facebook posts, tweets. People from across the country were incensed that the town would be celebrating Bergdahl's return. Right before I arrived for the interview with Dressel, her store had received its 11th angry call of the day. It wasn't yet noon. As the president of the local Chamber of Commerce, Dressel is helping with the welcome home celebration for Bergdahl at the end of the month.
I actually have some concerns about that now.
Like safety concerns?
I have safety concerns. I do. I've just never seen a turn of events happen so fast where you have such nasty remarks being made. I really am shocked.
People have called Bergdahl a traitor and a criminal who never should have been rescued. Those are some of the more PG comments. Some have vowed to come to Haley to demonstrate at the event. The mayor of Haley has responded with a statement asking people to withhold judgment until all the facts of the case are known. This was not the moment of triumph the town of 8,000 had been expecting. On Sunday, Bergdahl's father, Bob, thanked the community for their support over 5 long years.
The people in Haley, the Wood River Valley, you know, this little town in Idaho that was suddenly on the map.
Haley sits amid the foothills that grow into Idaho's Sawtooth Mountains. Bob and Jannie Bergdahl moved into one of the canyons here outside of town. They were off the grid for a time and homeschooled their kids Sky and Bo. Hiking trails on the sagebrush-covered hills were just minutes away.
You know, you'd see him out here on the trails and he was just head held high, smiling, walking, doing his thing.
That's Mark Lagulo. We're in Quigley Canyon, 3 miles from town. Lagulo's son Sean was friends with Bo when they were teenagers.
He's just a really good kid. His parents raised a really nice boy.
Some former members of Bergdahl's platoon have said Bergdahl mused about walking off into the similarly rugged hills of southeast Afghanistan. But Lagulo doesn't buy it.
No, I don't think so. Basically, this is a witch hunt. You know, old school, you know, ooh, you're guilty. Everyone says you are, so you must be. And only he knows what really happened.
If it turns out that back in June of 2009, he did walk off, would that change your perception?
No. No. I just think that we need to let those that are in charge deal with it. And in the meantime, just accept someone home that has been lost for a while.
The military does have an ongoing investigation. Bergdahl is still undergoing medical treatment in a military hospital, but an Army spokesman says interviews with him about what happened will eventually be a part of their inquiry. Minna Kasser is a neighbor of the Bergdahls. I met up with her in downtown Haley.
He's one of our own here. We're very happy that he's coming home.
She says if Bo Bergdahl did leave the base, there's another important question.
Why was he that angry? And I don't think that has come surfaced yet at all. And I think that's something that we're going to have to wait and hear from him or from someone about what really caused him to do that.
Kasser's daughter and Bergdahl used to be in the same fencing club. She says whatever happened in Afghanistan, it was complicated.
I don't think we should have to choose between him being a quote-unquote hero or committing treason. I think that there's some middle ground there. And we have to understand what really went on.
It's unclear how long that will take. What is clear to some is that no soldier should be left behind on the battlefield.
He was listed by the Department of Defense as a POW, and that's all that mattered to us.
That's right. He's the president of the Boise Valley POW-MIA Corporation and served in the Air Force for 2 decades.
We've been supporting Bob and Jenny since the very beginning as part of our mission. The POW mission is to make people aware and keep them aware. And our motto is never forget.
Kramer says every week the group has dedicated a couple of minutes to Bergdahl and kept a running tally of how many days he was missing. Kramer says he'll be at the welcome home celebration for Bergdahl at the end of June. As for the controversy surrounding Bergdahl's capture, Kramer says no comment. I'm Jessica Robinson reporting.
A survey of wolves in Denali National Park and Preserve this spring turned out the fourth lowest count since biologists started keeping track of the animals nearly 30 years ago. As KYC's Emily Schwing reports, Park Service officials say the numbers show a decline in the population, but they haven't settled on an explanation.
This year, biologists counted 51 wolves among 13 packs in a 17,640 square kilometer area. That's approximately the same size as 94 football fields. Simple arithmetic shows this year's is the lowest wolf population density ever recorded in the park and preserve. Steve Arthur is the park's biology program manager.
We do think that there's been a real decline in wolves over the last 6 or 8 years. Not a super steep decline, and we're at about the level that we were in the early 90s, which was following a decline in wolves that was in response to a reduction in caribou abundance.
There hasn't been a recent decline in the caribou population. In fact, Arthur says caribou numbers are slowly increasing. But he says they have moved to the north and east end of the park. The lowest number of wolves were recorded on the west side of the park, where there are fewer caribou. But Arthur doesn't have an explanation for why total population and population density estimates of wolves are so low.
Whether this is a serious decline, I guess that's kind of a matter of interpretation. Certainly the numbers are low. We're concerned that, you know, we wouldn't really want them to get very much lower than that. The question is, what is driving that? And we're fairly uncertain as to what's going on, and that's why we're monitoring the situation.
Biologists count wolves in Denali National Park and Preserve twice a year. Counts in the fall will provide information about the number of wolf pups born this spring. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
More than 4,200 bikers turned out for Bike to Work Day in Anchorage today. That's more than double the participants for last year's snowy event, when low numbers were blamed on the cold, wet weather. In 2012, about 3,800 bikers took to the streets and trails. Lori Skanke is the non-motorized transportation coordinator for the municipality. She says the number of riders counted at each special Bike to Work station has increased, but the percentage of people wearing bike helmets is down slightly to 87%. It was 92% last year. Anchorage Assembly members met on Tuesday to continue the conversation about the municipality's controversial labor law, AO 37. KSKA's Ann Hillman attended the subcommittee meeting.
The labor subcommittee and community members debated Assembly member Jennifer Johnston's proposed revisions of the municipality's old labor laws. In her version, unlike in AO 37, unions would still have the right to binding arbitration and the right to strike. However, her amended version of the labor law does give the administration more control over things like scheduling employees and equipment. But Johnston says the regulations could be negotiated.
And maybe the unions might know best. And if they know best, they can plead their case and they can make their case. And if it's a good case, it should be probably accepted. And if at some point there was a mayor who didn't accept their good case, that mayor and that administration have the full liability if something went wrong. Which, I'm sorry, the union doesn't have that liability. They don't have that accountability.
Johnston says she wants to discuss the nuts and bolts of the labor laws with the community before bringing it to the Assembly. The president of the Anchorage Central Labor Council, Daniel Rupeski, says he appreciates Johnston's attempts to fix the problems caused by AO 37.
There are some flaws in it, but I suspect that because of the makeup of the Assembly right now, that if her ordinance goes forward, her changes, that they'll be addressed through amendments by the Assembly. So I could deal with that. Again, I would prefer that AO 37 just disappear.
And it still could. Assembly member Dick Traney is proposing a motion to repeal AO 37 completely at the next Assembly meeting. Public comment would be taken on June 24th. The city is also working with the state's Division of Elections to determine how much it would cost to add the repeal to the November statewide ballot. If it does not go on the statewide ballot, the vote could be delayed until next April's municipal elections. The Assembly is trying to avoid a special election because of the high price tag. They'll make the decision by July 7th. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
A Canadian man started a horseback trip from Dead Horse to Mexico yesterday. Rider Len Crow is embarking on the 6,700-mile journey to raise money for orphanages, including a facility in Guadalajara, Mexico, where his ride is scheduled to wrap up in 11 months. Ride for Orphans communication manager Dan Wolf says the trip is the sixth and longest for the rancher-turned-pastor who has undertaken these rides for charity.
The goal is to open the eyes of folks to see that there is a need across the world for orphanages and to build them and to staff them, whereas a lot of folks in the United States in particular just feel like, you know, there's social services, there's foster care, there's things like that that can take care of these children. But in Mexico and other countries, those things just don't exist.
Wolf says Crow will travel with a van and support crew. He plans to cover 25 miles a day, rotating between three horses. The first stretch of Crow's Ride for Orphans will take him down the Dalton Highway. He plans to arrive in Fairbanks on July 3rd. The Ketchikan Gateway Borough Assembly voted to cut its share of funding for the city-owned Ketchikan Public Library. In 2010, city voters approved spending up to $5.2 million for the facility. Because borough residents were not allowed to vote on the issue, who should pay for services has been sometimes controversial. KRBD's Maria Dudzak reports.
The Assembly eliminated the 0.7 mil non-area-wide property tax during budget discussions Monday. The money generated from that tax, more than $405,000, is deposited in the city's general fund and helps support the Ketchikan Public Library. Assemblymember Glenn Thompson proposed the amendment.
Folks outside the city
did not have any input on the library, did not have any control over any of its funding, and are now paying an additional 0.5% sales taxes. This winds up, this 0.7 mils winds up being a double dip, and I think it's inappropriate, and I think we should just delete the whole program.
Asked if the borough is under any legal obligation to provide the funds next fiscal year, borough attorney Scott Brandt Erickson said no. He says an agreement between the city and borough is renewed on an annual basis, and that agreement expires at the end of the fiscal year. Assemblymember Bill Rotecki says he would like to see the city and borough work together.
But I think it could be done through more serious discussion than we've had in the past. Alternatively, and to me, much far more logically, since everyone in the borough uses the library, would be that it became a borough function. That, to me, would be the most logical thing to do.
Assemblymember Alan Bailey says the city and borough have discussed the library in the past, in part during Cooperative Relations Committee meetings. He says he has mixed feelings about the issue.
I'm just envisioning we're going to cut this out, and right behind this, then they're going to raise the taxes again. And I know that's not our problem, but it is a problem to our community. And it just, at what point do they stop? And at what effect does this have specifically on the city and the city the library by withdrawing these funds? What effect does this have? And I have concerns about that.
The Assembly voted 5-2 in favor of cutting the 0.7 mil non-area-wide property tax, therefore eliminating the borough's contribution to library funding. Any remaining residual funds will go into the non-area-wide fund and can be used for projects such as sewer repair. In Ketchikan, I'm Maria Dudzak.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Annie Ropeek and Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Dan Brasa and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Rosemary Alexander and Casey Kelly in Juneau, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Maria Dudzak in Ketchikan, and Jessica Robinson in Seattle. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki, Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust. Join the majority of Alaskans who understand that exposure to secondhand tobacco smoke endangers their health. The toxins in secondhand smoke go everywhere the blood flows, to all organs of the body, creating cellular changes that lead to cancer, heart attack, and stroke, miscarriage. For more information on how to eliminate exposure to secondhand smoke, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.